It was Captain Vere himself who of his own motion communicated the finding of the court to the prisoner, for that purpose going to the compartment where he was in custody, and bidding the marine there to withdraw for the time. Beyond the communication of the sentence, what took place at this interview was never known. But, in view of the character of the twain briefly closeted in that stateroom, each radically sharing in the rarer qualities of one nature, so rare, indeed, as to be all but incredible to average minds, however much cultivated, some conjectures may be ventured. It would have been in consonance with the spirit of Captain Vere, should he on this occasion have concealed nothing from the condemned one, should he indeed have frankly disclosed to him the part he himself had played in bringing about the decision, at the same time revealing his actuated motives. On Billy's side, it is not improbable that such a confession would have been received in much the same spirit that prompted it. Not without a sort of joy, indeed, he might have appreciated the brave opinion of him implied in his captain making such a confidant of him. Nor, as to the sentence itself, could he have been insensible that it was imparted to him as to one not afraid to die. Even more may have been. Captain Vere, in the end, may have developed the passion sometimes latent under an exterior stoical or indifferent. He was old enough to have been Billy's father, the austere devotee of military duty, letting himself melt back into what remains primeval in our formalized humanity, may in the end have caught Billy to his heart, even as Abraham may have caught young Isaac on the brink of resolutely offering him up in obedience to the exacting behest. But there is no telling the sacrament, seldom, if in any case, revealed to the gadding world, wherever under circumstances at all akin to those here attempted to be set forth, two of great nature's nobler order embrace. There is privacy at the time, inviolable to the survivor, and holy oblivion, the sequel to each diviner magnanimity, providentially covers all at last. The first to encounter Captain Vere in the act of leaving the compartment was the senior lieutenant. The face he beheld, for the moment one expressive of the agony of the strong, was to that officer, though a man of 50, a startling revelation. That the condemned one suffered less than he who mainly had effected the condemnation was apparently indicated by the former's exclamation in the scene soon perforce to be touched upon. Of a series of incidents, within a brief term rapidly following each other, the adequate narration may take up a term less brief, especially if explanation or comment here and there seem requisite to the better understanding of such incidents. Between the entrance into the cabin of him who never left it alive, and him who, when he did leave it, left it as one condemned to die, between this and the closeted interview just given, less than an hour and a half had elapsed. It was an interval long enough, however, to awaken speculations among no few of the ship's company as to what it was that could be detaining in the cabin the master-at-arms and the sailor, for it was rumored that both of them had been seen to enter it, and neither of them had been seen to emerge. This rumor had got abroad upon the gun-decks and in the tops, the people of a great warship being in one respect like villagers, taking microscopic note of every untoward movement or non-movement going on. When, therefore, in weather not at all tempestuous, all hands were called in the second dog-watch, a summons under such circumstances not usual in those hours, the crew were not wholly unprepared for some announcement extraordinary, one having connection, too, with the continued absence of the two men from their wonted haunts. There was a moderate sea at the time, and the moon newly risen, and near to being at its full, silvered the white spar deck, wherever not blotted by the clear-cut shadows horizontally thrown of fixtures and moving men. On either side the quarter-deck the marine guard under arms was drawn up, and Captain Vere, standing in his place surrounded by all the wardroom officers, addressed his men. In so doing, his manner showed neither more nor less than that properly pertaining to his supreme position aboard his own ship. In clear terms and concise, he told them what had taken place in the cabin, that the master-at-arms was dead, that he who had killed him had been already tried by a summary court and condemned to death, and that the execution would take place in the early morning watch. The word mutiny was not named in what he said, He refrained, too, from making the occasion an opportunity for any preachment as to the maintenance of discipline, thinking, perhaps, that under existing circumstances in the Navy, the consequence of violating discipline should be made to speak for itself. Their captain's announcement was listened to by the throng of standing sailors in a dumbness like that of a seated congregation of believers in hell listening to their clergyman's announcement of his Calvinistic text. At the close, however, a confused murmur went up. It began to wax all but instantly, then, at a sign, was pierced and suppressed by shrill whistles of the boatswain and his mates piping, "Down one watch." To be prepared for burial, Claggart's body was delivered to certain petty officers of his mess, and here, not to clog the sequel with lateral matter, it may be added that at a suitable hour the master-at-arms was committed to the sea, with every funeral honor properly belonging to his naval grade. In this proceeding, as in every public one growing out of the tragedy, strict adherence to usage was observed. Not in any point could it have been at all deviated from, either with respect to Claggart or Billy Budd, without begetting undesirable speculations in the ship's company, sailors, and more particularly man-of-war's men, being of all men the greatest sticklers for usage. For similar cause, all communication between Captain Vere and the condemned ended with the closeted interview already given, the latter being now surrendered to the ordinary routine preliminary to the end. This transfer under guard from the captain's quarters was effected without unusual precautions, at least no visible ones. If possible, not to let the men so much as surmise that their officers anticipate aught amiss from them, is the tacit rule in a military ship. And the more that some sort of trouble should really be apprehended, the more do the officers keep that apprehension to themselves, though not the less unostentatious vigilance may be augmented. In the present instance, the sentry placed over the prisoner had strict orders to let no one have communication with him but the chaplain, and certain unobtrusive measures were taken absolutely to ensure this point. In a 74 of the old order, the deck known as the upper gun deck was the one covered over by the spar deck, which last, though not without its armament, was for the most part exposed to the weather. In general, it was at all hours free from hammocks, those of the crew swinging on the lower gun deck and berth deck, the latter being not only a dormitory but also the place for the stowing of the sailors' bags, and on both sides lined with the large chests or movable pantries of the many messes of the men. On the starboard side of the Indomitable's upper gun deck, behold Billy Budd under sentry, lying prone in irons, in one of the bays formed by the regular spacing of the guns comprising the batteries on either side. All these pieces were of the heavier caliber of that period. Mounted on lumbering wooden carriages, they were hampered with cumbersome harness of breeching and strong side tackles for running them out. Guns and carriages, together with the long rammers and shorter linstocks, lodged in loops overhead. All these, as customary, were painted black, and the heavy hempen breechings, tarred to the same tint, wore the like livery of the undertaker. In contrast with the funereal tone of these surroundings, the prone sailor's exterior apparel, white jumper and white duck trousers, each more or less soiled, dimly glimmered in the obscure light of the bay like a patch of discolored snow in early April lingering at some upland cave's black mouth. In effect, he is already in his shroud, or the garments that shall serve him in lieu of one. Over him, but scarce illuminating him, two battle lanterns swing from two massive beams of the deck above, fed with the oil supplied by the war contractors, whose gains, honest or otherwise, are in every land an anticipated portion of the harvest of death. With flickering splashes of dirty yellow light, they pollute the pale moonshine, all but ineffectually struggling in obstructed flecks through the open ports from which the Tompion cannon protrude. Other lanterns, at intervals, serve but to bring out somewhat the obscurer bays, which, like small confessionals or side chapels in a cathedral, branch from the long, dim-vistaed, broad aisle between the two batteries of that covered tier. Such was the deck where now lay the handsome sailor. Through the rose tan of his complexion, no pallor could have shone. It would have taken days of sequestration from the winds and the sun to have brought about the effacement of that. But the skeleton in the cheekbone at the point of its angle was just beginning delicately to be defined under the warm-tinted skin. In fervid hearts, self-contained, some brief experiences devour our human tissue, as secret fire in a ship's hold consumes cotton in the bale. But now, lying between the two guns, as nipped in the vice of fate, Billy's agony, mainly proceeding from a generous young heart's virgin experience of the diabolical incarnate and effective in some men, the tension of that agony was now over. It survived not the something healing in the closeted interview with Captain Vere. Without movement, he lay as in a trance, that adolescent expression previously noted as his, taking on something akin to the look of a slumbering child in the cradle when the warm hearth glow of the still chamber of night plays on the dimples that at whiles mysteriously form in the cheek, silently coming and going there. For now and then in the jived one's trance, a serene, happy light born of some wandering reminiscence or dream would diffuse itself over his face and then wane away only anew to return. The chaplain, coming to see him and finding him thus, and perceiving no sign that he was conscious of his presence, attentively regarded him for a space, then, slipping aside, withdrew for the time, peradventure feeling that even he, the minister of Christ, though receiving his stipend from wars, had no consolation to proffer which could result in a peace transcending that which he beheld. But in the small hours he came again, and the prisoner, now awake to his surroundings, noticed his approach, and civilly, all but cheerfully, welcomed him. But it was to little purpose that in the interview following the good man sought to bring Billy Budd to some godly understanding that he must die, and at dawn. True, Billy himself freely referred to his death as a thing close at hand, but it was something in the way that children will refer to death in general, who yet among their other sports will play a funeral with hearse and mourners, not that like children Billy was incapable of conceiving what death really is. No, but he was wholly without irrational fear of it, a fear more prevalent in highly civilized communities than those so-called barbarous ones which, in all respects, stand nearer to unadulterate nature. And, as elsewhere said, a barbarian Billy radically was, quite as much so for all the costume as his countrymen, the British captives, living trophies made to march in the Roman triumph of Germanicus. Quite as much so as those later barbarians, young men probably, and picked specimens among the earlier British converts to Christianity, at least nominally such, and taken to Rome, as today converts from lesser isles of the sea may be taken to London, of whom the Pope of that time, admiring the strangeness of their personal beauty, so unlike the Italian stamp, their clear ruddy complexions and curled flaxen locks, exclaimed, "Angels!" meaning English, the modern derivative. Angels, do you call them? And is it because they look so like angels? Had it been later in time, one would think that the Pope had in mind Fra Angelico, seraphs, some of whom, plucking apples in the gardens of Hesperides, have the faint rosebud complexion of the more beautiful English girls. If in vain the good chaplain sought to impress the young barbarian with ideas of death akin to those conveyed in the skull, dial, and crossbones on old tombstones, equally futile to all appearance were his efforts to bring home to him the thought of salvation and a savior. Billy listened, but less out of awe or reverence, perhaps, than from a certain natural politeness. Doubtless, at bottom, regarding all that in much the same way that most mariners of his class take any discourse, abstract or out of the common tone of the workaday world. And this sailor way of taking clerical discourse is not wholly unlike the way in which the pioneer of Christianity, full of transcendent miracles, was received long ago on tropic isles by any superior savage, so-called, a Tahitian, say, of Captain Cook's time or shortly after that time. Out of natural courtesy he received but did not appreciate. It was like a gift placed in the palm of an outstretched hand upon which the fingers do not close. But the indomitable chaplain was a discreet man possessing the good sense of a good heart. So he insisted not on his vocation here. At the instance of Captain Vere, a lieutenant had apprised him of pretty much everything as to Billy. And since he felt that innocence was even a better thing than religion wherewith to go to judgment, he reluctantly withdrew. But in his emotion, not without first performing an act strange enough in an Englishman, and under the circumstances yet more so in any regular priest. Stooping over, he kissed on the fair cheek his fellow man, a felon in martial law, one who, though in the confines of death, he felt he could never convert to a dogma. Nor, for all that, did he fear for his future. Marvel not that, having been made acquainted with the young sailor's essential innocence, the worthy man lifted not a finger to avert the doom of such a martyr to martial discipline. So to do would not only have been as idle as invoking the desert, but would also have been an audacious transgression of the bounds of his function, one as exactly prescribed to him by military law as that of the boatswain or any other naval officer. Bluntly put, a chaplain is the minister of the Prince of Peace, serving in the host of the god of war, Mars. As such, he is as incongruous as a musket would be on the altar at Christmas. Why, then, is he there? Because he indirectly subserves the purpose attested by the canon. Because, too, he lends the sanction of the religion of the meek to that which practically is the abrogation of everything but force. The night so luminous on the spar deck, otherwise on the cavernous ones below, levels so like the tiered galleries in a coal mine, passed away. Like the prophet in the chariot disappearing in heaven and dropping his mantle to Elisha, the withdrawing night transferred its pale robe to the peeping day. A meek, shy light appeared in the east, where stretched a diaphanous fleece of white furrowed vapor. That light slowly waxed. Suddenly, one bell was struck aft, responded to by one louder metallic stroke from forward. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Instantly, the silver whistles were heard, summoning all hands to witness punishment. Up through the great hatchway, rimmed with racks of heavy shot, the watch below came pouring, overspreading with the watch already on deck the space between the mainmast and foremast, including that occupied by the capacious launch and the black booms tiered on either side of it, boat and booms making a summit of observation for the powder boys and younger tars. A different group, comprising one watch of topmen, leaned over the side of the rail of that sea balcony, no small one in the 74, looking down on the crowd below. Man or boy, none spake but in whispers, and few spake at all. Captain Vere, as before the central figure among the assembled commissioned officers, stood nigh the break of the poop deck, facing forward. Just below him, on the quarter deck, the marines in full equipment were drawn up much as at the scene of the promulgated sentence. At sea, in the old time, the execution by halter of a military sailor was generally from the foreyard. In the present instance, for special reasons, the mainyard was assigned. Under an arm of that yard, the prisoner was presently brought up, the chaplain attending him. It was noted at the time, and remarked upon afterwards, that in this final scene the good man evinced little or nothing of the perfunctory. Brief speech, indeed, he had with the condemned one, but the genuine gospel was less on his tongue than in his aspect and manner toward him. The final preparations personal to the latter being speedily brought to an end by two boatswain's mates, the consummation impended. Billy stood facing aft. At the penultimate moment, his words, his only ones, words wholly unobstructed in the utterance, were these: "God bless Captain Vere." Syllables so unanticipated, coming from one with the ignominious hemp about his neck, a conventional felon's benediction directed aft toward the quarters of honor, syllables which, delivered in the clear melody of a singing bird on the point of launching from the twig, had a phenomenal effect, not unenhanced by the rare personal beauty of the young sailor, spiritualized now through late experiences so poignantly profound. Without volition, as it were, as if indeed the ship's populace were the vehicles of some vocal current electric, with one voice from alow and aloft came a resonant echo, "God bless Captain Vere." And yet at that instant Billy alone must have been in their hearts, even as he was in their eyes. At the pronounced words and the spontaneous echo that voluminously resounded them, Captain Vere, either through stoic self-control or a sort of momentary paralysis induced by emotional shock, stood erectly rigid as a musket in the ship armorer's rack. The hull, deliberately recovering from the periodic roll to the leeward, was just regaining an even keel when the last signal, the preconcerted dumb one, was given. At the same moment it chanced that the vapory fleece hanging low in the east was shot through with a soft glory, as of the fleece of the Lamb of God seen in mystical vision, and simultaneously therewith, watched by the wedged mass of upturned faces, Billy ascended, and ascending took the full rose of the dawn. In the pinioned figure, arrived at the yard end, to the wonder of all, no motion was apparent save that created by the slow roll of the hull, in moderate weather so majestic in a great ship heavy cannoned. A digression. When, some days afterwards, in reference to the singularity just mentioned, the purser, a rather ruddy, rotund person, more accurate as an accountant than profound as a philosopher, said at mess to the surgeon, "What testimony to the force lodged in the willpower?" The latter, spare and tall, one in whom a discreet causticity went along with a manner less genial than polite, replied, "Your pardon, Mr. Purser. In a hanging, scientifically conducted, and under special orders I myself directed how Buds was to be effected, any movement following the completed suspension and originating in the body suspended, such movement indicates mechanical spasm in the muscular system. Hence the absence of that is no more attributable to willpower, as you call it, than to horsepower. Begging your pardon. But this muscular spasm you speak of, is not that in a degree more or less invariable in these cases?"
"Assuredly so, Mr. Purser."
"How, then, my good sir, do you account for its absence in this instance?"
"Mr. Purser, it is clear that your sense of the singularity in this matter equals not mine. You account for it by what you call willpower, a term not yet included in the lexicon of science. For me, I do not, with my present knowledge, pretend to account for it at all. Even should one assume the hypothesis that at the first touch of the halyards, the action of Bud's heart, intensified by extraordinary emotion at its climax, abruptly stopped, much like a watch, when in carelessly winding it up you strain at the finish, thus snapping the chain, even under that hypothesis, how account for the phenomenon that followed?"
"You admit, then, that the absence of spasmodic movement was phenomenal?"
"It was phenomenal, Mr. Purser, in the sense that it was an appearance, the cause of which is not immediately to be assigned."
"But tell me, my dear sir," pertinaciously continued the other, "was the man's death effected by the halter, or was it a species of euthanasia?"
"Euthanasia, Mr. Purser, is something like your willpower. I doubt its authenticity as a scientific term. Begging your pardon again, it is at once imaginative and metaphysical, in short, Greek. But," abruptly changing his tone, "there is a case in the sick bay that I do not care to leave to my assistants. Beg your pardon, but excuse me."
And rising from the mess, he formally withdrew. The silence at the moment of execution, and for a moment or two continuing thereafter, but emphasized by the regular wash of the sea against the hull, or the flutter of a sail caused by the helmsman's eyes being tempted astray, this emphasized silence was gradually disturbed by a sound not easily to be verbally rendered. Whoever has heard the freshet wave of a torrent suddenly swelled by pouring showers in tropical mountains, showers not shared by the plain, whoever has heard the first muffled murmur of its sloping advance through precipitous woods, may form some conception of the sound now heard. The seeming remoteness of its source was because of its murmurous indistinctness, since it came from close by, even from the men massed on the ship's open deck. Being inarticulate, it was dubious in significance further than it seemed to indicate some capricious revulsion of thought or feeling such as mobs ashore are liable to, in the present instance possibly implying a sullen revocation on the men's part of their involuntary echoing of Billy's benediction. But ere the murmur had time to wax into clamor, it was met by a strategic command, the more telling that it came with abrupt unexpectedness. "Pipe down the starboard watch, boatswain, and see that they go."
shrill as the shriek of the seahawk, the whistles of the boatswain and his mates pierced that ominous low sound, dissipating it, and yielding to the mechanism of discipline, the throng was thinned by one half. For the remainder, most of them were set to temporary employments connected with trimming the yards and so forth, business readily to be found upon occasion by an officer of the deck. Now each proceeding that follows a mortal sentence pronounced at sea by a drumhead court is characterized by promptitude, not perceptibly merging into hurry, though bordering that. The hammock, the one which had been Billy's bed when alive, having already been ballasted with shot and otherwise prepared to serve for his canvas coffin, the last office of the sea undertakers, the sailmaker's mates, was now speedily completed. When everything was in readiness, a second call for all hands made necessary by the strategic movement before mentioned was sounded, and now to witness burial. The details of this closing formality it needs not to give. But when the tilted plank let slide its freight into the sea, a second strange human murmur was heard, blended now with another inarticulate sound proceeding from certain larger sea-fowl, who, their attention having been attracted by the peculiar commotion in the water resulting from the heavy sloped dive of the shotted hammock into the sea, flew screaming to the spot. So near the hull did they come that the strider or bony creak of their gaunt double-jointed pinions was audible. As the ship under light airs passed on, leaving the burial spot astern, they still kept circling it low down with the moving shadow of their outstretched wings and the croaked requiem of their cries. Upon sailors as superstitious as those of the age preceding ours, man-of-war's men, too, who had just beheld the prodigy of repose in the form suspended in air and now floundering in the deeps, to such mariners the action of the seafowl, though dictated by mere animal greed for prey, was big with no prosaic significance. An uncertain movement began among them, in which some encroachment was made. It was tolerated but for a moment, for suddenly the drum beat to quarters, which familiar sound happening at least twice every day, had upon the present occasion a single peremptoriness in it. True martial discipline, long continued, superinduces in average man a sort of impulse of docility, whose operation at the official tone of command much resembles in its promptitude the effect of an instinct. The drumbeat dissolved the multitude, distributing most of them along the batteries of the two covered gun decks. There, as wont, the gun crews stood by their respective cannon erect and silent. In due course, the first officer, sword under arm and standing in his place on the quarterdeck, formally received the successive reports of the sworded lieutenants commanding the sections of batteries below. The last of which reports being made, the summed report he delivered with the customary salute to the commander. All this occupied time, which in the present case was the object of beating to quarters at an hour prior to the customary one. That such variance from usage was authorized by an officer like Captain Vere, a martinet as some deemed him, was evidence of the necessity for unusual action implied in what he deemed to be temporarily the mood of his men. "With mankind," he would say, "forms, measured forms, are everything. And that is the import couched in the story of Orpheus, with his lyre spellbinding the wild denizens of the woods." And this he once applied to the disruption of forms going on across the channel, and the consequences thereof. At this unwonted muster at quarters, all proceeded as at the regular hour. The band on the quarterdeck played a sacred air, after which the chaplain went through the customary morning service. That done, the drum beat the retreat, and toned by music and religious rites observing the discipline and purpose of war, the men in their wonted orderly manner dispersed to the places allotted them when not at the guns. And now it was full day. The fleece of low-hanging vapor had vanished, licked up by the sun that late had so glorified it. And the circumambient air and the clearness of its serenity was like smooth white marble in the polished block not yet removed from the marble dealer's yard. The symmetry of form attainable in pure fiction cannot so readily be achieved in a narration essentially having less to do with fable than with fact. Truth, uncompromisingly told, will always have its ragged edges. Hence the conclusion of such a narration is apt to be less finished than an architectural finial. How it fared with the handsome sailor during the year of the Great Mutiny has been faithfully given. But though properly the story ends with his life, something in way of sequel will not be amiss. 3 brief chapters will suffice. In the general rechristening under the directory of the craft originally forming the navy of the French monarchy, the St. Louis line of battleship was named the Athieste. Such a name, like some other substituted ones in the Revolutionary fleet, while proclaiming the infidel audacity of the ruling power, was yet, though not so intended to be, the aptest name, if one consider it ever given to a warship. Far more so, indeed, than the Devastation, the Erebus, the Hell, and similar names bestowed upon fighting ships. On the return passage to the English fleet from the detached cruise during which occurred the events already recorded, the Indomitable fell in with the Athieste. An engagement ensued, during which Captain Vere, in the act of putting his ship alongside the enemy with a view of throwing his boarders across the bulwarks, was hit by a musket ball from a porthole of the enemy's main cabin. More than disabled, he dropped to the deck and was carried below to the same cockpit where some of his men already lay. The senior lieutenant took command. Under him, the enemy was finally captured, and though much crippled, was, by rare good fortune, successfully taken into Gibraltar, an English port not very distant from the scene of the fight. There, Captain Vere, with the rest of the wounded, was put ashore. He lingered for some days, but the end came. Unhappily, he was cut off too early for the Nile and Trafalgar. The spirit, that despite its philosophic austerity, may yet have indulged in the most secret of all passions, ambition, never attained to the fullness of fame. Not long before death, while lying under the influence of that magical drug which, soothing the physical frame, mysteriously operates on the subtler element in man, he was heard to murmur words inexplicable to his attendant, "Billy Budd, Billy Budd." That these were not the accents of remorse would seem clear from what the attendant said to the Indomitable senior officer of Marines, who, as the most reluctant to condemn of the members of the Drumhead Court, too well knew, though here he kept the knowledge to himself, who Billy Budd was. Some few weeks after the execution, among other matters under the head of News from the Mediterranean, there appeared in a naval chronicle of the time an authorized weekly publication, an account of the affair. It was doubtless for the most part written in good faith, though the medium, partly rumor, through which the facts must have reached the writer, served to deflect and in part falsify them. Because it appeared in a publication now long ago superannuated and forgotten, and is all that hitherto has stood in human record to attest what manner of men respectively were John Claggart and Billy Budd, it is here reproduced. On the 10th of last month, a deplorable occurrence took place on board HMS Indomitable. John Claggart, the ship's master-at-arms, discovering that some sort of plot was incipient among an inferior section of the ship's company, and that the ringleader was one William Budd, he, Claggart, in the act of arraigning the man before the captain, was vindictively stabbed to the heart by the suddenly drawn sheath-knife of Budd. The deed and the implement employed sufficiently suggest that though mustered into the service under an English name, the assassin was no Englishman, but one of those aliens adopting an English cognomen whom the present extraordinary necessities of the service have caused to be admitted into it in considerable numbers. The enormity of the crime and the extreme depravity of the criminal appear the greater in view of the character of the victim. A middle-aged man, respectable and discreet, belonging to that minor official grade, the petty officers, upon whom, as none know better than the commissioned gentlemen, the efficiency of His Majesty's Navy so largely depends. His function was a responsible one, at once onerous and thankless, and his fidelity in it the greater because of his strong patriotic impulse. In this instance, as in so many other instances in these days, the character of the unfortunate man signally refutes, if refutation were needed, that peevish saying attributed to Dr. Johnson that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. The criminal paid the penalty of his crime. The promptitude of the punishment has proved salutary. Nothing amiss is now apprehended aboard HMS Indomitable.
Everything is, for a season, remarkable in navies. Any tangible object associated with some striking incident of the service is converted into a monument. The spar from which the fore topman was suspended was for some few years kept trace of by the Blue Jackets. Then knowledge followed it from ship to dockyard and again from dockyard to ship, still pursuing it even when at last reduced into a mere dockyard boom. To them a chip of it was as a piece of the cross. Ignorant though they were of the real facts of the happening, and not thinking but that the penalty was unavoidably inflicted from the naval point of view, for all that they instinctively felt that Billy was a sort of a man as incapable of mutiny as of willful murder, they recalled the fresh young image of the handsome sailor, that face never deformed by a sneer or subtler vile freak of the heart within. This impression of him was doubtless deepened by the fact that he was gone, and in a measure mysteriously gone. On the gun decks of the Indomitable, the general estimate of his nature and its unconscious simplicity eventually found rude utterance from another foretopman, one of his own watch, gifted, as some sailors are, with an artless poetic temperament. The tarry hands made some lines, which, after circulating among the shipboard crew for a while, finally got rudely printed at Portsmouth as a ballad. The title given to it was The Sailors. Billy in the Darbies. Good of the chaplain to enter Lone Bay, and down on his marrow bones ear and pray, for the like's just to me, Billy Budd. But look, through the port comes the moonshine astray. It tips the guard's cutlass and silvers this nook, but 'twill die in the dawning of Billy's last day. A jewel block they'll make of me tomorrow, pendant pearl from the yardarm end, like the eardrop I gave to Bristol Molly. Oh, 'tis me, not the sentence they'll suspend. Aye, aye, all is up, and I must up too, early in the morning aloft from alow. On an empty stomach, now never it would do. They'll give me a nibble, bit of biscuit ere I go. Sure a messmate will reach me the last parting cup, but turning heads away from the hoist and the belay, heaven knows who will have the running of me up. No pipe to those halyards, but aren't it all sham? A blur's in my eyes, it is dreaming that I am. A hatchet to my panzer, all adrift to go, the drum roll to grog, and Billy never know. But Donald, he has promised to stand by the plank, so I'll shake a friendly hand ere I sink. But no, it is dead, then I'll be, come to think. They'll lash me in hammock, drop me deep, fathoms down, how I'll dream fast asleep. I feel it stealing now. Sentry, are you there? Just ease these darbies at the wrist and roll me over fair. I am sleepy, and the oozy weeds about me twist.
The End. You've been listening to Billy Budd by Herman Melville, narrated by Frank Muller. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Moby Dick, also by Herman Melville, and narrated by Frank Muller. And The Far Side of the World by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.